Good morning. The scripture comes from Matthew chapter 3, verses 16 and 17, and also chapter 4, verses 1 through 4. As soon as Jesus was baptized, he went up out of the water. At that moment, heaven was opened, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and alighting on him. And a voice from heaven said, "This is my Son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased." Then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. After fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. The tempter came to him and said, "If you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread." Jesus answered, "It is written, 'Man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God.'" This is the word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. Please be seated.
Well, good morning. Y'all doing okay? All right, parents, one more time, just a heads up. A little later in the message, we'll be showing a video clip from the movie Blood Diamond. It's a great movie. Any Leonardo DiCaprio fans in the house? Come on, Leo fans, where are you at? I see you. Clip is a really powerful clip, but at the same time, it could be startling for young children. So if you do want to take this moment to go ahead and get them checked in the children's ministry, I will not be offended. In fact, all you'll miss is some really bad jokes and witty banter. Okay, so if you want to go and do that now, go for it. But how many of you can remember your first crush? Raise your hand. It's okay if you're married. It's like middle school. Get over it, right? First crush. Remember your first crush? I remember mine. Carly Day. Hubba hubba. Carly Day. Yeah. I was a sophomore. She was a freshman. First time I saw her was I was in weights class. And she was in freshman PE. And she comes into the gym. And all the guys do immediately what guys do when they're trying to impress a girl, right? Put way too much weight on the bar. You do like push-ups. You just, right? I remember thinking, man, she's beautiful. And a couple of days later, some of my friends came up to me and they said, "Hey, you know what we heard? We actually heard Carly thinks you're cute." Now, what you have to understand is I haven't always been the example of the male specimen that you see before you. I was really self-conscious, especially in high school, super self-conscious, very insecure. And so I didn't believe them at all. In fact, I thought they were just trying to get me to make a fool of myself. Like, yeah, give me a break. Carly thinks I'm cute. Whatever, right? So I did what every single guy does. When you have a crush on a girl, but you don't have the guts to actually tell them or ask them out, I like went around the back there. I was like, "Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be your friend. We're going to be friends," right? And then once she gets to see how great I am, she's going to tell me how she feels, right? So I don't have to do anything because we're cowards, right, fellas? Who's with me? Come on. You know, y'all know what happened next. What happened next? I got stuck in the friend zone. How many of y'all know a thing or two about that, right? Like pretty soon she's telling me about all the guys she's got crushes on, asking for dating advice. It's a miserable place to be. Fellas, never go there. Never go there. It's awful. This went on for a couple years through high school. Somewhere in college, things kind of shifted and she really did become just a really good friend. In fact, Trevor dated her. What's up with that? Trevor. In fact, I think we should give him a mic. We should come down here and talk about this, right? No, we were like really good friends, but I remember this one night all hanging out. I think it was right before I was going to move from, you know, Indiana to South Carolina, and we're just talking and she says something and she's like, "Do you know, Nick, there for a while, I had like this crush on you and I never understood why you never asked me out." I was like, "Are you kidding me? Really? Like what my friend said was true? I spent all that time in the friend zone for nothing, right?" Now, obviously, things worked out really well for me. I married the love of my life, Lindsay Grace. Have you seen her, by the way? Have you met her? She's amazing. Hope we get the chance to meet my wife. But, you know, I tell that story because I think it proves a point. It's one thing to hear a bit of good news, but it's quite another to actually trust it, right? To believe it. To live out of it. See, we're in the midst of this series we're calling Victorious, where we're really working to confront the strongholds in our life. And strongholds are those places where you and I, we feel defeated, right? Like there's that good and healthy and positive thing that we're trying to start in our life, but for whatever reason, we can't seem to commit to it. Right? Or there's like this negative thing, this unhealthy thing that we want to stop doing, or maybe it's somebody we want to move away from, but for whatever reason, we can't seem to let go of it. How many of you know what I'm talking about? These are strongholds. I mean, I'm sure plenty of us resonate with the words of the Apostle Paul in the book of Romans. Man, I don't understand the things I do. It's like the thing I know I should do, I don't do that. Instead, I do the very thing I know I shouldn't do. I'm like, amen, right? These are strongholds. And so the good news of Jesus Christ isn't just that there's life after death, as good as that is. At the same time, the good news of Jesus Christ is that there is also life before death, right here and now. So for the hope for this series, the goal for this series is for you and I to experience victory. Everybody say victory. In these areas of our life, by confronting the very real enemy on the inside of us and the very real enemy on the outside of us, by putting to work the weapons and the practices that God has made available to us in Jesus Christ and through the Holy Spirit. And today, the weapon we're going to take a look at is the weapon of truth and the practice of trust. So if you have your Bibles, open them up to Matthew chapter 3. Yes, I know it will be on the screen, but again, I love to hear those Bible pages turning. And in fact, if you didn't bring one and you'd like, we got the Pew Bibles in front of you. It's on page 682. Matthew chapter 3. Now, Matthew chapter 3 is really where the story sort of really takes off in Matthew's gospel. This is where the action begins. The first couple chapters, we have the birth narrative and we have some genealogies. All of this stuff is important, but the action really starts right here in chapter 3. And before Jesus' ministry goes public, right, before he does anything out there in front of everybody else, we have Jesus being baptized by John. Notice what happens when he comes up out of the water. At that moment, heaven was opened, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and lighting on him. And a voice from heaven said, "This is my Son, whom I love. With him, I am well pleased." Now tell me something. What has Jesus accomplished so far? What has he done? Has he preached his first sermon yet? Has he started to draw all sorts of crowds to him? Has he performed a miracle yet? Turned any water into wine? Walked in any water? Healed any sick people? What has he done? He's been baptized. And we have him here at the very beginning of his public ministry, before he's done any of the remarkable things, receiving a blessing from God. Blessing, it's love, it's affirmation, it's acceptance. And we see Jesus receiving this from God before he's done any of the remarkable things you and I, we still talk about today. I mean, it isn't like, oh, I'm God, this is Jesus, I'll tell you what, do a couple remarkable things, do some cool stuff, and then I'll tell you how I feel about you. No, from the very beginning, before any of that, we have Jesus receiving from God love and acceptance. This is the God Jesus introduces us to. It's a God whose first word over us is blessing, who loves and accepts us. It cannot be earned. It cannot be achieved. It's just simply given and received. This is the love of a parent. And you know, this is really one of the hardest things for me to wrap my brain around. Grew up in the church. I heard all that. God's like a father, all that, yada, yada, yada. Sounded cool, but I didn't really know what it meant until I became a dad myself. And now I get it. Because with my kids, my love for them, man, it's just always sort of been theirs. It's like, what's funny is when we found out my wife was pregnant with our firstborn, our son, I started writing him a journal. I just would write in it from time to time, like things I wanted him to know. And I've tried to do that for all the kids since. But I was so caught off guard by the feelings I had for this kid, even before I met him. When he was still, you know, in his mother's womb. It blew my mind. This is the only relationship I have in my life that works like that too. Like my wife, our love, as great as it is, it wasn't always there. Believe me, it wasn't always there. It took me a while to convince her to give me a shot, right? That sort of love was developed. It was earned in a sense, right? It came from a commitment, from a relationship. Not so with my kids. I love them because they're my kids. That's just how it is. I mean, they don't do that much for me. In fact, I spent a whole lot of money taking care of their rear end, right? I mean, money goes to diapers and wipes and blah. I mean, I don't love them. Somebody just got that. That's great. Woman. But I don't love them because of what they do for me, right? And this love is just theirs. They're my kids. I love them. Bottom line, that's how it works. This is the love that God reveals to us in Jesus Christ. It's the kind of love that can't be earned or achieved. It's just simply given and received. You know, as good as that sounds, and a lot of us have been in church for a while, this isn't the first time we've heard it, right? It's one thing to hear that. It's another thing to actually trust it, to believe it, to allow it to influence how we live. Because notice what happens next. In chapter 4, right after he's baptized, Jesus is led into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. Did you notice the temptations? Listen to this first one from chapter 4, verse 3. The tempter came to him and said, "If you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread." If you are the Son of God. What has God just told Jesus? "You are my son, whom I love. With you I am well pleased." If you are the Son of God. It's always a temptation, isn't it? To doubt that what God said is true about us. That we are loved and accepted from the beginning. That that is the truest thing there is that we are loved by God. I mean, here we begin to really see the enemy's tactic, his strategy. It's character assassination. What the devil wants us to do is to doubt that what God said is true. I mean, this has been his MO from the very beginning. Go back to Genesis chapter 3. When the devil tempts the first human beings, how does he do it? Did God really tell you? Wait, hold on. Did God really tell you not to eat from that one tree? Let me guess. He probably told you that if you do, what, you're going to die? Is that what he said? Give me a break. You're not going to die. Evie, can I call you Evie? Is that okay? You are not going to die if you eat this. And in fact, here's what's going to happen. See, God doesn't want you to know this. But if you eat from that tree, then your eyes are going to be opened. You're going to be enlightened. In fact, you're going to be like God. You see, he's holding out on you. He is holding out on you. He doesn't have your best in mind. He wants to keep you stuck where you are. What you need to do is get a hold of that fruit. You eat a piece of that fruit, you won't even need God anymore. You'll be able to figure all this out on your own. This is the devil's strategy. It's character assassination. It's to get us to doubt that what God has said is true. Hear me when I say this. The devil is a liar. He's a liar. I mean, Jesus says he is the father of all lies. His name, it means deceiver. And at the heart of all of our sin, all of our brokenness, all of our dysfunction in us and in the world around us, it's a lie. The source of that is a lie. It's a lie that is out to get us to doubt that what God said is true, that his love and acceptance is simply enough. It's this lie that tells us that there's something else out there besides God that will satisfy, that will make us whole. And think about all the ways this lie shows up in our life. Again, this is one of those things, those of us who have grown up in church, we're like, yeah, I've heard this before. But you know what? It is so true. You've heard it before because it is true. I mean, think about how this lie manifests itself in our life. When we buy into this lie, one of the things we do is we try and find our life from other things. And usually that means we try to find how do we measure up compared to everybody else. Just be really honest with me for a second. How much of what you do or don't do is driven by the fear of what other people think? I'm up here right now and I want you to like me. I want you to laugh at my jokes. In fact, the only reason I'm wearing this coat is because I knew Pastor Jeff would like it, right? Don't get used to it. Oh, but it's true. I mean, we try to find our life and our value from how we measure up. What we have, what we've done, what we've achieved compared to everybody else. In fact, I turned 32 last summer. I remember my 32nd birthday that night, looking up on the computer, all of like my favorite influential church leaders, like the ones that I really look up to around the country. And I looked up, I wanted to see how old they were. Not only that, I did some work to try and figure out, well, how old were they when they made their big contribution, when they wrote the book, right? When they preached that sermon, how old were they? Why was I doing that? I was trying to find some sense of life from comparing what I've achieved up to 32 compared to what they had achieved up to 32. Can I tell you what? There's no life there. I didn't sleep well that night. But there's no life there. And if our identity and our worth comes from where we compare, we're always going to find somebody who's achieved more, accomplished more. This is what Ecclesiastes calls a chasing after the wind. There's no life there. Here's another really obvious one. We buy into this lie. We try and find our life from what we have, from our stuff, from our possessions. But we know how that goes, right? We say, man, if I could just get a hold of this, if I could just have that, then we get it. New stuff becomes old stuff and we're on to something else. And we rent out storage bins to keep all of our stuff that we don't even care about anymore. I mean, marketing people make a killing off of this. Watch a commercial next time. Here's the strategy. You're missing something, aren't you? You feel that little emptiness in you? Well, what you need to do is you need to buy our product and then you'll be great. So what we do is we buy into the lie that what we really need is like another ShamWow, right? It doesn't work. Here's the honest truth. America is the wealthiest country in the world, but we're also the most addicted, the most medicated, the most oppressed. It's not working. It's not working. We buy into this lie. And those are some of the real obvious ways we do that. But I've also noticed some less obvious ways too. It's like when things are going really good, right? You're in one of those seasons and it's like, man, this is great. Maybe you're doing really well at the office or things at home are really good, but things are going great. And you have this moment of awareness and clarity. It's like, man, this is really good. If you're anything like me, there's this other voice that kicks in right in that exact moment. And it usually goes something like this. This almost feels too good. How long is this going to last? When is this thing going to fall apart? Like, when is the other shoe going to drop? Right? Because this just feels too good. And we get kind of paranoid, right? Thinking, oh man, anytime good comes our way, we better hold on because some bad's about to come as well. How many know what I'm talking about? I was sharing this with my wife the other day, and she was telling me about how at night she has this thing she does. You know, we tuck the kids in and we go spend some time together. And then before we go to bed, she always goes back in their rooms to check on them, make sure they're okay. And plus, it's just really fun to stare at them because they're beautiful when they're still, right? And she tells me that often she has this moment where she's looking at the kids and she just has this overwhelming sense of gratitude, right? Just joy, how beautiful they are. But in that exact same moment, when she realizes how beautiful it all is, this other voice starts coming in her head and starts telling her all the bad things that could happen to them, right? Or you start feeling this sting, this pain, because you know as hard as you try, you can't stop them from growing up, right? You're losing them. Isn't it crazy how that can happen in the same moment? The same moment she feels this joy and this gratitude. She feels this despair and this dread. All that's based on a lie. It's based on a lie about God. And for some of us, the way we experience this is when things are going good, what we start to feel is some sort of guilt. It's like the voice says, man, you don't deserve this. You should be feeling really guilty. Like, how many of you have ever been on vacation? Right? You're at vacation, everybody else is in the office, and you're not checking your email, but all you do is feel some sort of weird, I don't deserve this. I shouldn't be here. You see this a lot in relationships too. It's like somebody finally enters into a healthy relationship with somebody who's good for them. And then what they hear in their head is, I don't deserve this. This person is too good for me. And any good thing, it doesn't last, especially when they find out who I really am. And so they sabotage it. You know what I'm talking about? All this is based in a lie. It's based in a lie about God. That either God only has so much good to go around, so we get insecure about the good that we do have, right? Or that God's not going to let us experience any sort of good without countering it with bad. This is also why it's really hard for us to celebrate for other people. And if something good comes their way, we get all insecure because we think it means less good is available to us. So they get the promotion. They get the relationship. Or we get all insecure about how we think their kids are doing compared to our kids. Do you see what I'm talking about? This is a lie. It's a lie that we believe about God. This is not the God Jesus Christ reveals to us. A God whose first word over us, continuing word over us, is love and acceptance. So often, you and I are like that person tearing apart their house, trying to find their keys, only to realize they've been in their hands the whole time. You're not going to find what you're looking for. What other people think about you, what you're able to accomplish, and what you have or what you don't have. Man, the keys are in your hand. You're loved by God. You are loved by God. And you know what? That's enough. Man, for many of us, what keeps us from having a healthy practice of trust is what's behind us. Because the devil loves to use things like guilt and shame. And as soon as you hear those words, certain things come to mind, don't they? Secrets, right? Previous failures, mistakes. We can even feel guilt and shame for the things that have happened to us. But man, the good news is Jesus Christ introduces us to a God who's in the forgiving business. I love what Ephesians chapter 1 says. It says, in him we have redemption through his blood, the forgiveness of sins in accordance with the riches of God's grace. God's got plenty of grace to go around. Forgiveness of sins. Whatever it is that's causing you guilt or shame, it's trying to hold you back. Guess what? It's been dealt with. Jesus is taking care of it. It's been sent away. God is on your side. How many of you need to hear that? You're forgiven. God knows about the secrets. God knows about the addiction. God knows about the lies. He knows about the cheating. He knows about the stealing. He knows about the abuse. He knows about the abortion. He knows about all of that. And in Jesus Christ, you're forgiven. You are forgiven. I'd call that some pretty good news. Wouldn't you agree? You see, you know what the gospel is? The gospel is the disruptive announcement about who we are and about what is true about us in Jesus Christ. It's disruptive because it often confronts what we believe about ourselves and the lies that we're continually told. It's disruptive. Jesus Christ tells us who we are, what is true about us. The question is, are we going to trust it? Are we going to believe it? Are we going to actually begin to live out of it? There's a powerful scene in Blood Diamond. Blood Diamond came out in 2007, and it takes place during the Sierra Leone War. It happened in the late 90s. And one of the main characters is this father. And these rebel soldiers come into his village and they take one of his sons away. And throughout the movie, these rebel soldiers are brainwashing this child, turning him into a child soldier. So throughout the movie, you see this father trying to track down his lost son, going through obstacle after obstacle, difficulty after difficulty, trying to find his lost son. All the while, we see these scenes of this boy being corrupted, being polluted. These rebel soldiers, they tell him lies. They tell him, you're a bad boy. You're a killer. You're a machine. They put a gun in his hand. They teach him how to shoot it. So again, all throughout the movie, this father is looking for a son while his son's being more and more polluted, more and more corrupted, until finally, at the end of the movie, the father is able to track down his lost son. But he is so twisted, so polluted, he has a gun and it's pointed at his father. And there's this moment where the father realizes this child soldier is in fact his son. Let's watch. It's powerful. And you know what? That's the gospel. It's the gospel. I know they made you do bad things, but you're not a bad boy. I'm your father who loves you, and you will come home and be my son again. And as the father speaks these words, you can see the wrestling match going on in that child's mind, right? Because it's not the only voice he hears. He also hears the voice of all the lies he's been told. So the question is, which one is he going to trust? As the father continues to speak these words, he caves in, he gives in. It's the gospel. That's the gospel. It's this disruptive announcement about who we really are, and what is true about us. The question is, are we going to trust it? Because what I've learned is that in life, those voices of guilt and condemnation, they're never going to really go away. This is part of life on this side of the resurrection. The question is, which voice are we going to listen to? And so in the end, how do we put this weapon of trust to work? How do we grow in a practice of trust? Well, I think the first thing we have to do is we have to expose the lie. Expose the lie. See, when it comes to our strongholds, those things in our lives we want to see change, what often happens is that you and I, we get really fixated like on the behavior, on the bad behavior, right? We just want to change that. But if all we do is concentrate on the bad behavior without exposing the lie, then what happens is you and I, we just trade one cage for another. I mean, for instance, like me and my weight. Don't know if you've noticed or not, but I've lost about 20 pounds since January. You can clap for that. Come on now. Come on. Come on. Just kidding. But for me, this cannot be just about losing weight. It can't be. Because if it is, I'm just trying to change that behavior without exposing the lie. One of two things is going to happen. One, I'm going to lose a bunch of weight, and then that becomes my new cage. All my identity is like, how skinny can I look? And I'm going to tell you, with hips like this, it's just not going to happen, right? Or I can lose a whole bunch of weight, but if I don't expose the lie, then 6 months later, what am I going to do? I'm going to put it right back on. So for me, the hard work is, why do I do this? why do I go to the refrigerator or the pantry whenever I'm feeling empty? And I know we tend to like make eating things just silly around here. We don't really talk about it. But for those of you in the room, you know what I'm talking about. This is a stronghold for us. It can be incredibly frustrating. We got to expose the lie. Why do we do that? So when it comes to whatever is stronghold in your life, expose the lie. Why do you go to the computer screen at night after everybody's in bed? Why do you do that? What lie have you bought into? Man, why do you buy way more stuff than you really need? Why do you look for your worth and your value and your identity from how you measure up? Why does a bad day at the office wreck you the way that it does? Man, do the hard work. Expose the lie. What is this really about? At the same time, exposing the lie, it's also about acknowledging the enemy's presence and activity in our lives. Because like me, I'm going to tell you right now, when it comes to spiritual warfare, the whole aspect of our faith, it can make me uncomfortable. And so often with the unhealthy things in my life, I just try to make them way too rational. Now, this isn't about the devil or the enemy. This is about me and my bad thoughts and my bad behavior. Listen, the enemy is sneaky. 2 Corinthians chapter 2 speaks of the enemy's tactics, his strategies, his schemes. He's crafty. He will slow cook you if he has to. And what he'll do is get you to believe in the lie that either he isn't involved or the problem really isn't a problem. I got this under control. I can quit when I want to. This isn't really that big of a deal. The thing is, it is a big deal. Because there's a very real enemy who wants to take you out and he wants to take other people out through you. Hebrews chapter 3 says to us, speaking about God's voice, today when you hear his voice, don't harden your hearts. And when you feel that sense of conviction, right? When you get a sense that something isn't healthy, something isn't right, how do you respond to that? Because what we tend to do, especially when it's something that we kind of enjoy and we don't want to let go of, we rationalize it away. It's not that big of a deal. It's not a problem. We're going to be okay. It is a problem and it needs to be dealt with immediately. Because if we're not careful, what ends up happening is we get to the point where we start calling the truth a lie and the lie a truth, and we become deaf to the voice of God. What lie have you bought into? How have you compromised, rationalized? So it begins with exposing the lie, but it's also about exercising the truth. We go back to Matthew chapter 4. How does Jesus fend the devil off? What does he use? Scriptures. Right, the temptation is, if you are the Son of God, then turn these stones into bread. Jesus counters. He says, man shall not live on bread alone, but by every word that comes from the mouth of God. What we see from Jesus, probably one of the things that I admire the most about him. You read through the Gospels, he lived with this unwavering trust in what God has said. When God told him at the baptism that he was loved and accepted, you know what? Jesus believed him. And he lived this beautiful life because of it. He could speak hard things to people and watch them turn their backs on him. And guess what? He was okay. I mean, he could go through difficult things and it didn't rock him. It didn't move him. I mean, did he get his feelings hurt? I'm sure he did. But man, he lived a beautiful life. And it's because he had this unwavering trust in God. But it wasn't innate in Jesus. I mean, I know we say, well, wasn't he like God with skin on? Yeah, but he was also very human. And Hebrews actually tells us he had to learn obedience. This trust was a result of these certain rhythms and practices that Jesus lived by. One of them was his commitment to the scriptures, to the word. You know, one of the most powerful ways we deal with a lie is to hold it up to the truth. But how can you do that if you're not familiar with it? Let me ask you a real simple question. What is your relationship like with the word? Is there any time that you carve out, you set aside to read through the scriptures? If you're looking for a good first step in your bulletin, I put together 7 days worth of scripture readings and 2 simple questions I want you to ask every time you read these passages. How does this passage encourage me? And how does it challenge me? Where's resistance at in me? Man, spend this week. If you're looking for a first step, there it is. Try that out. At the same time, I believe that the scriptures, it's a book we shouldn't read alone, but it really comes to life in the context of community. Wednesday night, Trevor Miller is teaching a Bible study right here in this room on the book of James. Come on out. See what happens. Allow God to remind you of what is true. Because in the end, you know, trusting the scriptures is way more than just simply knowing them. It's about choosing to live out of them. It's like what Jesus says in John chapter 8. He says this, if you hold to my teaching, some translations say, if you continue in my teachings. You really are my disciples, my students. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. I love this word for to hold or to continue in. It's one of John's favorite words. Sometimes it's translated as to abide or to remain, but it's this idea of living, dwelling, making your home in this place. It's about learning, continuing to trust that what God said is true, to embrace the saving love of God, no matter how we feel about it, or no matter what the other voices may say. It's like when I became a parent, I didn't really feel like one. In fact, it was really terrifying. How many parents am I talking about? Here's your kid. See you later. It's like, up to that point, I haven't been able to keep a goldfish alive longer than a week. I mean, funny story. Last Saturday, my wife and I decided to get the kids some fish. Three goldfish have died in my keeping in less than a week. I'm not going to lie. So here I was, responsible for a human being. It's like, what am I supposed to do? I don't feel like a parent. But when that kid was born, my identity changed. Whether I felt like it or not, I was a parent. And since then, I've had to learn to live and act and make decisions out of that new identity. And you know what? In the process of that, I'm growing into a pretty good parent. Do I make mistakes? Oh, yeah. Those mistakes don't define me, and I've gotten pretty good at saying I'm sorry. In the same way, when we identify with Jesus Christ, when we embrace the saving love of God revealed to us in Jesus Christ, our identity changes. We become what the scriptures call a new creation. And the whole of the Christian life is about learning to live into that, to take our cues, not from the voices we hear in our head, but from the truth that we know from God, that we're a new creation. Are we going to make mistakes? Yep. Those mistakes, they don't define you anymore. In fact, God will teach you things through them. You'll become even better than you were before. So here in a moment, Jack's going to lead us through one more song. And in this space, in this presence, I really want you to do business with God. If you want to come down to the altar, if that's your thing, go for it. But do business with God. And on one hand, some of you maybe have never said yes to the saving love of God in the first place. Man, Jesus tells us that who the Son sets free will be free indeed. That means that we need Jesus to do this for us, to set us free, to make us right. Maybe that's your prayer in this space. But for the rest of us, maybe what we need to do is we need God to expose the lies we've bought into and remind us of what is true. Maybe it's some sense of despair you've allowed to take over. There's something you've quit on. Maybe it's you, your marriage, another person, a situation, whatever it is. Maybe what we need to do is need God to remind you of what is true, that in Jesus Christ, today doesn't have to be like yesterday. What truth do you need to be reminded of? Let's worship.